I want to welcome all of you to the fourth and final Texas Water Symposium for this series. As a matter of curiosity, how many of you have been to previous programs in the series? So almost all of you. Anybody fortunate enough to attend all of them, the previous three? A smaller number, but still a healthy showing. I congratulate you. For those of you that weren't able to attend or listen to the previous programs, the first one was here at Shriner University, and we heard primarily from managers of the water resources, water authorities, the Edwards Aquifer Authority and the like. They described for us their job in managing those water resources to meet the not only the present water needs of their areas, but also the future water needs and the increased population growth. And we heard that their jobs are incredibly complex, a lot of competing interests to be addressed, needs to be met, economic ramifications, environmental ramifications, legal ramifications, and in some cases ethical ramifications as well, that they needed to consider planning and making available water resources for the people of Texas. The second program was at the TTU campus, or actually it was at Nimitz Museum near the Texas Tech campus in Fredericksburg, where we learned from the scientists, again, that the science of water is incredibly complex. What we have essentially is a finite water supply. We can't make any more water. What we can do is perhaps a better job of developing existing water resources so that it's more available when and where we need it. But those developments come at a cost, an economic cost, and oftentimes an environmental cost as well. They describe some of the things that science can do, what it can tell us, but also some things that we don't yet know that are beyond the limits of our current science. And decisions need to be made sometimes in the face of a lack of total certainty as to the consequences of some of our decisions. The third program at the Texas Tech campus in Junction talked about conservation, primarily how can we utilize the water that we have more efficiently to avoid some of these economic, environmental, and other costs that we had learned about. And here we are back at Shriner University, sort of where we started, to try to pull some of those concepts together in our discussion of policy, planning, and politics. Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here in addressing this important issue of water? We're fortunate to have a distinguished panel to share their thoughts with us and engage in a conversation with us. We had originally intended for our first speaker to be Senator Averett, who is we knew he was going to be unable to be here in person, but we had arranged, and he is perhaps as we speak attempting to telephone in. He is virtually here with the speakerphone and the microphone waiting for the phone to ring, and as soon as it does, we will connect him and hear his thoughts, and I will introduce him at that time. But for our purposes, he certainly has been involved in Texas water issues from the legislature and other perspectives for many years. So we are definitely hoping that he makes it through the electronic vagaries to join us tonight. In his absence, we will begin the program with Myron Hess, who is legal counsel and director of Texas Water Programs for the National Wildlife Federation. He works in their Gulf States Natural Resource Center in Austin. Mr. Hess has a degree in wildlife and fisheries science from Texas A&M University and a law degree from the University of Texas. He has more than 20 years of legal and other experience that has concentrated mainly on water quality and availability, as well as endangered species here in Texas, and has a a broad and extensive background in the area. Mr. Hess.
Good evening. Pleasure to be here. And I'm glad to be sharing the podium this evening with Laura Marbury, who you'll hear about, is a person I've had the pleasure of working with for many years, and a virtual Senator Everett, we hope, and Senator Robert Puente. And I wanted to note that I think it's really great to have, we hope, Senator Puente, Chairman Everett and Chairman Puente, on the panel, because they're both very knowledgeable about water issues in Texas. And I think one of the things that's really struck me about the way they run their committees is that they're people who are really committed to listening. You know, there are so many perspectives on water issues, and both of them are willing to listen even late into the night, very late into the night, to get different perspectives to try to reach good decisions on these really critically important water issues. And I think that's a real testament to them, and I very much appreciate that. What I want to do tonight is touch very briefly on some of the key challenges, and I know you will have heard about most of these, that relate to the water arena in Texas and in the Hill Country, and then spend a little time talking about two specific issues that I believe are particularly important for the Hill Country in dealing with some of those challenges. So what are those challenges? The first one, it's obviously no surprise to you, you've been hearing about this population growth issue that we're facing, the projection that basically our population is going to double in Texas by about 2060. So I was trying to think of some context to think about that. So I looked back to get some figures and found that the population of Texas in 1850 was about 200,000 people. In 1950, it was 7.5 million people, and the projection is by 2050, it's going to be more than 40 million people. Now, I didn't want to project that out and start thinking about what it would look like in 2150. I just can't deal with that, but I guess I don't have to worry about it. I'm not likely to be around. But that kind of growth rate is pretty phenomenal to think about the challenges of how we deal with that. Well, that amount of growth, that huge amount of growth, is not going to be evenly distributed across the state, projected to center on the, sort of an I-35 corridor and on urban areas. So that San Antonio area, Bexar County is projected to grow by about 75% in the next 40 to 50 years. So counties near those urban areas like Kendall and Bandera County are projected to have over a 300% growth in that same period. And as that growth happens, what's going on is that we are paving over the areas that supply our aquifers, that supply our rivers, and that affects the water quantity, the water quality. It also affects our flooding issues. So those are huge issues in their own right. But in addition to that, all those new people are going to need water. So where's that going to come from? So you heard the remarks before, the overall amount of water in Texas, in the world for that matter, is set. It is what it is. It's not growing. That's the amount of water we have to work with. And that available water, whatever it is, generally isn't where the growth is. That's in itself another huge challenge. So the bottom line is to supply these new people with water, that water is going to have to come from someone else or somewhere else. And for everybody involved, it has value where it is now. So redistributing that water, even on a voluntary basis, is a very tough and sometimes very painful process. Another quick point to recognize is that drought and water availability during drought is what drives our water planning, water availability decisions. Drought periods are obviously when the water supply is at its lowest and the water demand is at its highest. And that particularly is water demand for lawns and crops and that sort of thing. So, again, a big challenge. And what the scientists are telling us is that droughts are going to worsen. We basically, in water planning, what we have always done is based our planning on the idea that the next 50 years of rainfall are going to be an exact repeat of the last 50 years of rainfall. Does anybody want to give me odds on the likelihood of that actually happening?
Better you should bet on the lottery.
And I didn't. Well, we know that's not going to happen exactly, but, you know, the restriction has been, you know, what have you got that's better in terms of predicting what the next 50 years are going to be like specifically? But one of the things we're finding now is the climate change predictions are telling us that it could change very dramatically with a great reduction. And, yes, even on a cold night like this, I do believe in global warming. I do believe that the vast majority of the scientific evidence is indicating that our climate is changing, and that's going to have dramatic impacts. What does that mean for Texas in the area of water availability? The climate models have significant uncertainty in them, and particularly when it comes to trying to predict precipitation down to the level of a state the size of Texas. You know, it's hard to get that kind of precision, but generally what those models say is that in the western part of the state, the rainfall is probably going to decrease slightly on average. The eastern part of Texas, where there is more rainfall, it may increase slightly. Another prevailing view about rainfall is that it's going to be more episodic, and that seems to be pretty broadly accepted, just meaning that rain, the overall average, annual average may not change dramatically, but it's going to be more in huge rainfall events and long, hard droughts. So that pattern is going to change, and that seems to be a pretty broadly held view. But I think the most sobering realization for me is that even if the rainfall amount basically stayed about the same, with an increase in temperature, the net effect is to have less water. And the reason for that is that the higher temperature means faster evaporation, the water that falls down, it never becomes available, and faster transpiration from the plants. So that even if the rainfall didn't change, just by the temperature going up, the net effect would be less water. And some predictions are saying that by 2060, it could mean 25 to 30% less available water for areas like the Hill Country of Texas. So I don't know how you're feeling. Right now I'm feeling sufficiently challenged by the statistics that I'll transition and start talking a little bit about those other issues. Specifically, what I want to talk about are the issue of environmental flow protection as it relates to the Hill Country and water conservation and drought management, but I really want to talk about some of the challenges, not to so much planning for those approaches, but how do we get them implemented and on the ground effectively. Well, environmental flows, you know, one way to look at that is it's just a fancy term for the recognition that a river and stream is better off with water in it than without water in it, and that coastal estuaries need fresh water flowing into them. It's sort of that simple. In my view, in the Hill Country, it's particularly important because the beauty and the health of the streams and rivers here are increasingly important to the economy of the Hill Country. I don't have a study to prove this, but it's long been my contention that a stream with water in it is a better tourist attraction than a stream without water in it. And I certainly think that if you start looking at land values, those lands with flowing streams by them are valued a heck of a lot higher than ones without it. Well, our water rights system in Texas until quite recently just flat hasn't recognized the value of environmental flows. Fortunately, last year, with the leadership of Chairman Averitt and Chairman Puente, the legislature created a program that says we're going to go out and try to quantify how much water we need in our rivers and flowing into estuaries to keep them healthy and productive. And we're going to begin the process of trying to provide that water to meet those needs. That's a huge step. So where there's water available, and by available it means it's not already been spoken for in the permitting system, some of that water would be set aside and say that is water for environmental flows. It's not available for permitting for other purposes to be taken out. Well, of course, the challenge is that in a lot of places in Texas, so much of the water has been spoken for that there's not going to be enough set aside for that. So we're going to have to be more creative about figuring out how do we ensure that our streams continue to flow. This new process, it calls for stakeholder groups and science advisors that work sort of by basin. They're going to make recommendations on how much water is needed for environmental flow protection in that particular basin. And it's based on a combination of science and policy. We're saying the science tells us this, and we look at the policy sort of balancing what are the human needs, what are the environmental needs, and sort of what's the right answer for this basin. Then recommendations will come out of that. We'll go to the state environmental agency, and they'll actually adopt formal standards that sort of spell out, okay, this is the amount we're going to be shooting for. And this is going to be done on sort of a staggered basis across the state. The first two basins in East Texas, the Sabine and Sabine Neches and the Trinity San Jacinto, are starting up in the next few weeks. And the process in the Colorado and Guadalupe basins, which includes much of the Hill Country, is scheduled to start up in late this fall, in September, to have the stakeholder groups appointed for that. That process is only going to be successful if the stakeholder groups really have balanced representation of all the interests. Because if that's not true, the process is going to lose its credibility. We won't get us where we need to go, because the key to success here is to have all the different stakeholder groups buying into the result because they were represented at the table. You know, they really had a say in the result of that process. If we don't have that, we don't get ourselves down the road. And I think that's really critical for moving us forward on implementing all sorts of water options, because if we talk about this issue of reallocating water from one area, redistributing water from one area to another, one of the things you want to know is, well, how much do we need to make sure stays in this area to keep our rivers healthy, our streams healthy, to keep our economies healthy? And that's the sort of information we need out of this process. So just a request to you to start thinking about this process that's starting in September, about whether you could be a stakeholder in that process to participate, to represent interests in that stakeholder process to determine how much water needs to stay in these streams and rivers in the Hill Country. Well, let me switch then to the issue of conservation and drought management. And I want to talk about both of those, so let me first make the distinction of what I'm talking about. Thank you. By conservation, I'm talking about the measures that we use day in, day out to use water more efficiently, the ones you probably commonly think about, you know, which are low flush toilets, high efficiency sprinkler systems. They're just sort of the common sense everyday mechanism to use water more efficiently. When I talk about drought management, I'm talking about more stringent measures that we would employ only during those drought periods to further stretch our supplies. And examples of that could be things like lawn watering restrictions, or more inventive measures, things like what we call the dry year option, where you might have one user pay, for example, an irrigator during a drought, pay them not to irrigate, so that that water then is available for some other use during those drought periods. But those collection of things. But the combination of those two, of conservation and drought management, is just about being smarter about how we use water, getting more done with the same amount of water. There are a lot of people who say, yeah, water conservation is a great thing. We need to do more of it, but it's not enough. You know, we're not going to solve our water needs with just conservation. And I don't disagree with that. You know, there are needs in parts of Texas that are certainly going to have to be met with things other than conservation, but our conservation drought management. But it can do a lot. It can do a lot more than we are doing with it now. Because recognize that those new sources of water are increasingly rare, they're expensive, and they're controversial. And realistically, we have just begun to tap the potential of water conservation. And I think the reason for that is that the incentives really haven't been there in most places to really get serious about it. One of those reasons is that water's been cheap. I mean, let's face it. Relative to your other daily expenses, how much do you spend on water? Particularly relative to its absolute worth, in our lives and in the natural world around us, incredibly cheap. With rare exceptions up to now, we've always been able to tap additional sources of water. So, you know, if you needed more water, you just went and got it somewhere else. That's the way we've done it. But that's not going to be as easy in the future. And finally, let's face it, water utilities need money to run their utilities, and that money comes from the sale of water. So if you sell less water, you either raise the rates or have less income, and neither one of those are very popular. So that's been the difficulty. And I think so far the impacts of increased use of water haven't been all that dramatic in most places. They certainly have in some places. There are examples, but that could change pretty quickly. Some of those examples, Comanche Springs in Fort Stockton, you may be familiar with that. It used to be a spring that flowed all the time. It had a stream associated with it that went about 30 miles. But now, because of the amount of pumping out of the aquifer, it basically only flows intermittently after sort of heavy rainfall events. Usually it's a dry area in Fort Stockton, a huge loss. In 2002, the Rio Grande in Big Bend National Park stopped flowing, fortunately for only a short period, as a result of a combination of drought and increased diversions in Mexico. But the reality is, as this population continues to grow, we could see that sort of thing happening more and more. So what is it that's going to take to get us to do this serious water conservation? I mean, we talk about it. It's in our planning documents. But are we doing it? How do we get to the point that every water user is using water as efficiently as possible every single day? That's a big step from where we are today, a huge step. Is it going to take incentives? Is it going to take requirements, government regulations? Is it going to require these new users that come in, require them to pay for water conservation for existing users so that they can get some of that water for them? And I think the answer is yeah. It's going to require every one of those and a lot more inventive things than that. But we really have to get serious now about moving beyond planning and talking and get to implementing. So quickly, a couple points on drought management. It's much less acknowledged, much less commonly acknowledged in our conversations about water than conservation is. Conservation is sort of something we've talked about a long time. It's been accepted. Drought management's a tougher sell. It involves, I think, more sacrifice, frankly, than water conservation. It may mean things like refilling private swimming pools during droughts, or restricting lawn watering to the extent that lawns really do suffer during droughts. And what that's about, I think, is deciding, we have to decide during these periods of drought, of water shortage, what uses are most important to put that water to. Is it most important to put it on lawns? Is it most important to keep it in rivers? We have to make some of those decisions and then have a management system that allocates that water in some manner. Because it works directly on that drought demand, which, as I mentioned earlier, is what drives planning, it really has a big potential to affect the decisions we make going forward. That dry year option, let me just talk briefly about that. Again, what that concept is, if you had an irrigator who grows crops, if you had a deal where they could get paid an adequate amount of money not to irrigate during a really dry year, a dry period, then potentially that water could go downstream, be used by a municipality during that dry year. The municipality pays the farmer not to water. But just some of the time, so the farmer doesn't have to go out of business, again, gets compensated, you know, to get through that year, a way to decide, well, where should that water be used? What's the best use for it? And allow the money to make that sort of allocation. It's not going to work everywhere because you have to have some mechanism. How can you physically move the water from one use to the other? But there are certainly places it can work. It's been experimented a little bit in the Edwards Aquifer. It's tough to figure out the pricing to make it work, but there's some big potential for that sort of thing. And one of the advantages of it is that when you look at some of the other alternatives, for example, building a new reservoir, you build a new reservoir to meet drought demands, but a lot of the time you're not in drought. So you've built the reservoir, you have the expenses incurred with it, tied up with it all the time, but you don't really need the water. You need the water during the drought years. So if you can come up with some of these other mechanisms that really get directly at the drought, there's some real potential for it. So I appreciate your time. I look forward to attempting, at least, to answer some of your questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Most of you in the audience have been to previous programs of ours and know the format, but for those of you that aren't familiar with the format, we'll have each of the panelists make their brief introductory remarks, and then we will open the session to questions and answers so that you can engage in a discussion with the panelists. Our second speaker tonight is Representative Robert Puente, who is a graduate of St. Mary's University in San Antonio, where he studied political science, and also the University of Texas Law School. Representative Puente was elected to the Texas House in 1991 and has recently announced his retirement. And I learned something this evening. He is listed in the program as a former Texas State Representative. And I understand I received a history lesson from Representative Puente that apparently it's not that easy to retire from the legislature, that under the Constitution, you are the legislature until the your successor is elected. And the election is in May. So in describing Representative Puente, I will carefully use the present tense. He is the representative, and we are very fortunate to have him here this evening. Among his other responsibilities in the legislature, as Mr. Hess mentioned, he's been chair of the House Natural Resources Committee. He's been instrumental in a number of landmark water legislations, including passage of the Edwards Aquifer legislation, establishment of the Edwards Aquifer Authority, and certainly significantly the passage of Senate Bill 1, which created the water planning process that we use in Texas. As I said, he's recently announced his retirement from the legislature, and I understand that one of the many new hats that he's going to be wearing is as a consultant, helping private companies deal with issues such as desalination of brackish aquifers to perhaps utilize some water that hasn't been available previously. Representative Puente.
Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here in Kerrville, and thank you to Shriner University, Texas Tech University, for inviting me to be here, but specifically to Weir Labatt. He is not here. He is a former city councilman from San Antonio. He's also on the Texas Water Development Board. He made sure that I accepted the invitation, and I'm glad to do so. When I give water talks, I always like to mention, and either I mention it or some other speakers will talk about how important water is. They have great adjectives to describe it, the lifeblood of our economy or of life itself. And I always add the second part, that water is very, very important, but only after a drought and only when there's a budget surplus in the legislature. Other than that, we don't really treat water the way we should, legislatively, politically. And if you look at what the state of Texas has done in the recent years, it's always been after those two events. Senate Bill 1 and Senate Bill 2, big, huge, landmark water planning bills came in the 1990s, right after the droughts of the 1990s. And also during that time was a period of budget surpluses where we had some money in the bank. The state of Texas had a budget surplus, so we were able to fund a lot of the planning that we needed, the regional planning group. So that was two events that coincided that let us start having a good water policy for our state. Senate Bill 3, which was a follow-up to Senate Bill 1 and 2, was just passed this past legislative session in 2007. Remember, we had a drought in 2006. We didn't have a budget surplus, and Senate Bill 3 didn't necessarily cost any money. There's nothing in there that really requires the expenditure of money by the state. So that's what we're looking at as a state, and that's what we kind of deal with when we talk about the politics of water. So when we do that, when we have to answer the questions of where do we go from here, policy, planning, and politics, they all interrelate with each other. The planning affects the policy affects the politics. If you don't have the right politics, you can't do the planning or have the right policy. So it's a political game. It's a political situation that we all have to try to have a good handle on. And then politics, again, plays a role, and especially in the next 3 years, 2011, when we will have a redistricting year, where we will reapportion the representation of our state. And as Myron Hess talked about, that huge growth corridor along I-35. Rural counties, rural areas will lose representation. It'll go to the not necessarily the urban centers of Texas, but the suburban centers of Texas. The huge growth that in Bexar County will not necessarily be just in the city of San Antonio, but it'll be within the outer reaches of Bexar County, all the surrounding counties around Bexar County, Atascosa, Kerr, Gillespie, Bandera, Comal, Guadalupe, all of that circle around Bexar County. That's where the huge, huge growth will be. And that's where you'll see that urban, suburban, rural fights in the legislature, and again, how they deal with water. So when we reapportion, when West Texas will realize that they will lose representation at the expense of San Marcos or Austin or Bexar County or Dallas, there will be legislative fights. And a lot of them deal with water, because where's the water? A lot of the water is not there in Dallas. It's not there in San Antonio. It's not there in Austin. It's in the rural parts of the state. So that politics will also have a hand in what we do. And again, the context of all this is also played with in regionalism, this region of the state versus that region of the state. Protectionism, this is my water, this is my land, this is our water, it's for our growth, knowing that that county is not going to grow. It never has grown, it never will grow. If it does, it's very minimal, and so you have to understand that, but you also have to appreciate the need and the want from these individuals that they need to protect their way of life, they need to protect their natural resources. So all of these come into play when we talk about where are we going and what do we do next. The legislature meets every other year. It'll meet in 2009. That's not that far away, about 10 months away. And so some of the issues we'll be addressing will have all this interplay affected in them. One of them is something that happened out of Senate Bill 1, which is almost a prohibition of interbasin transfers. Interbasin transfer is simply getting water out of one river basin, transferring it to another river basin. It's allowed. You need a permit to do it, but there's about 25 different obstacles that you have to go through to get that permit approved by TCEQ, by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. So you have that protectionism. A region wants to protect their water resource, but there has been, since that prohibition has been in place, there's been such a tremendous pressure put on groundwater, and that's why you've seen this last 10 or 15 years a tremendous amount of development of groundwater resources. Not only the water itself coming out of the ground, but the policy and the politics and legislation regarding groundwater. And so I think next session you'll, and you've seen it since it passed in the 1990s, the prohibition against interbasin transfers, legislation filed to address that, to try to alleviate some of those obstacles to have interbasin transfers. As I said, legislation is introduced, but it never gets anywhere. But each session, there's more of a likelihood, more of a need to do that. And we've had, since the 1990s, at least one redistricting year, 2001. We'll have another one, 2011. And then, so you'll see more representation of urban and suburban interest, and maybe more numbers there to try to get this prohibition changed. As I mentioned, this caused a lot of pressure on groundwater. Groundwater districts are formed to protect the resource, to protect it from overpumping. What we have seen is state representatives, state senators come to the legislature on behalf of their home communities and ask for a groundwater district to have that protection. And invariably, it'll be a single county groundwater district to protect that particular situation. Well, all of you know that aquifers don't understand, don't respect county lines. So we've seen that, again, regionalism. We've seen situations where they're created. And what we have been trying to do, but it's been very unsuccessful, Senator Averett and I, is to try to get districts formed not along just county lines, but region-wide, aquifer-wide, so that we can have a better management of that groundwater resource. As I mentioned, we've been unsuccessful, but one success we did have was the passage of a bill by Robbie Cook. He's a representative also retiring from Eagle Lake, which is between San Antonio and Houston, on a bill that sort of asked and mandated cooperation between groundwater districts, so that if they were over the same aquifer, so that at least you know what the other one is doing. One groundwater district, their rules and regulations shouldn't be so different from its neighbor to where one can take the advantage of the other, or there's not the correct amount of protection that you need for that groundwater. Another issue with groundwater that we're going to see, that bill that passed by Robbie Cook had some key language in it that is called desired future conditions. What is your desired future condition of your aquifer, of your groundwater district? And each groundwater district is told to come up with a number as to what amount of pumping can it sustain and have your desired future condition. If you, on a local basis, want your desired future condition to be a stable aquifer where the recharge and the withdrawals are essentially the same so that you have a stable aquifer, and if that is it, then you make that part of your plan and you send it up to Austin. Other aquifers, because of the circumstances, recognize that there's going to be a drawdown. There's going to be a mining of that aquifer. All of the groundwater districts in the panhandle essentially are mining the aquifer. There is so little recharge over there that their desired future condition is withdrawals for the next 50 years, and after that, who knows what's going to happen. So we're going to see a lot of groundwater districts coming up with these numbers, having regional fights as to what that number should be, what that desired future condition should be. And within the district itself, you'll have some of those fights. It's not just the urban, suburban fight against the rural fight. So within the district, you're going to have that huge landowner who realizes and understands he or she can make more money selling that water than farming, than ranching. And why should I, as that landowner, not be able to get my water and ship it down a pipe into the urban area if that's what I want to do? If we respect private property rights, why should that individual not be allowed to do that? And the other argument, obviously, of course, is that it's a community interest. It's a resource for the entire community, that if you export all of the water, that particular farming community may not survive. And so you'll have these inner fights within the districts themselves. And invariably, the loser either goes to the courthouse or goes to the state house to try to change the rules at the state level, or if he or she feels that they've been really taken advantage of at the local level, they go to the courthouse and try to make their resolutions there. When I first started in the legislature in 1991, some of the problems back then actually were, I don't want this water, this wastewater, I just want to dump it and get rid of it. Now, obviously, the argument is, it's wastewater, but I want to keep it. It's no longer something I want to put in the river, in the stream, and let it flow downhill all the way down to the Gulf. And so once you use that water and it becomes wastewater and you want to put it back in the stream, whose does it become? If it was yours originally and it was groundwater and you still retain it, the law says that it's still yours. But if it was surface water and you're using it and you put it back in the stream, is it surface water again? And if you captured it, can you pick it up downstream again? So these are some of the rules that the legislature, I was going to say weep, but I'm going to be gone, that the legislature is going to look at to see what are the rules, what is fair. Obviously, if you're downstream, you want that water flowing downstream. If you're upstream, you're going to say, it's my water, I want to continue to use it, and it may not be as important as before. The committee that I chaired also deals a lot with districts, not just groundwater districts, but other types of districts that are created. And the sole purpose of the creation of these districts is to allow for development of usually what was once rural and is now suburban, either municipal utility districts, water improvement districts, some type of district that allows a funding mechanism to bring water into that area for the development that's occurring there. And so that's going to be another challenge, is how do we handle the growth that we're experiencing, and especially in this hill country area and all along this area around San Antonio. Beautiful country. The same reason you're here are a lot of the reasons why other people want to come here. And so how is that growth going to be handled? And is it going to be handled in a planned growth type of way, or is it going to be nilly-willy where septic tank after septic tank, and good luck with the water that you're able to capture for your development? So the committee that chairs the chairman of Natural Resources next session will have that opportunity to see all of the development growth and these proliferation of districts and how they interplay with water and wastewater and the growth of our state. One big issue that was always real big for me was water conservation. Every session, I usually filed around 10, maybe even up to 15 different water conservation bills. Invariably, half of them would pass. The next session, I would try to pass the other half and collect new ideas, new information, and file another set of water conservation bills. And what I learned is that everyone loves water conservation. They think it's the greatest thing on earth, that it's the cheapest source of getting additional water, and that it's so great, so important that they should do it, not me. They should do it because they have the tax base that allows them to do it. They should do it because my industry is already doing this, or we're already doing that, or it's too expensive to do this or do that. And a lot of times that was true. And a lot of smaller cities do not have a tax base to be as innovative or have all of the policies, for example, that San Antonio has on water conservation. In San Antonio, if you're a developer, the grass that you put into your development can no longer be St. Augustine grass. It has to be a drought-tolerant type of grass. And the developer, the home builder, gets a credit for that. He or she is either able to put it to their bottom line or give it to the homeowner as an incentive, a cheaper home for them to buy. So a lot of these things, every golf course in San Antonio is irrigated with reuse water. Some of these things smaller communities can't do because they don't have the tax base that San Antonio has. To do these, maybe our water bills went up $1 or $2, $3 over maybe a 5-10 year period. That's a smaller community. It would be a much bigger hit, tens of dollars over a shorter period of time. So we recognize that in the legislature that there are some ways to do good and cost-effective water conservation, and that there's other situations where not everybody should have to do that, that it should be piecemeal or tailored exactly to that particular community. But what I've also learned is some of these water conservation measures that used to be considered a green idea or environmental idea or for the kooks out of Austin, not here, those other kooks out of Austin, that it's not like that anymore, that there is money to be made by water conservation. So the free enterprise system, the free market system, those businessmen and women that have been making money have come to realize that there's money to be made by water conservation because water is becoming expensive, because customers are looking for and demanding certain types of water efficiency standards within the new homes. And this is mostly new development. It's very difficult to have this for existing type of a home. And so they have learned that, for example, irrigation systems, and by irrigation I'm talking about lawn irrigation, your home, that a lot of these sensors can be manipulated with satellite, that they are able to receive information about moisture in the ground, moisture in the air, a potential of rain the next day, to where their sensors will tell the system not to turn on. And so if you're buying a home, it's a lot cheaper to have that in place, and the developer, the builder, home builder can show over 5 years you'll save this amount of money and it'll pay for your system itself. And we know that water conservation is not about turning off the water when you brush your teeth, about taking shorter showers. It's important. That's what we teach our second graders. But what truly is the issue about water conservation and about drought management is the need for us people that live in cities to irrigate our lawns. We are obsessed with that little patch of green lawn in the front and the back of our homes. And the San Antonio water system, the Dallas system, the Houston system, all water systems are built for that one day in August when it hasn't rained for about two or three weeks, and everybody wants to irrigate their lawn. Everybody wants to turn on their sprinklers to irrigate their lawn. So that system has to be able to address that one day where everybody wants to do it. Otherwise, it collapses. So we have to recognize that as a state. It's very difficult to change these types of habits because everybody thinks, well, you know, I'm only irrigating my lawn. I mean, why can't I irrigate my lawn? And so it's an education process. Water conservation is an education process. What we have done in the legislature, again, is made it a top priority. A water conservation task force that looks at best management practices, incentives that we've put in place for people that want to use these measures. And so hopefully, now that I'm leaving, the legislature will continue to see that water conservation is cost-effective, and I think the free, as I mentioned, the free market will make it continue to be a very important matter for water policy. And so if we still ask that question of where do we go from here, I think the way I would answer it is we go where we've been. We always are looking at improving our public education system. We never get there. We always look at improving our criminal justice system. We never get there. So our water policy has to be something of a constant improvement, a constant new ideas, new policies, a constant vigilance on the correct type of planning, the water planning that we've set up under Senate Bill 1, and also, especially the general public, has to be involved in the politics of that, of getting those things done. And it's not just about electing the right person, because you never know who the right person is. Obviously, if you go through a campaign, you'll hear the worst of the individual, of both individuals, and you're left with, you know, what am I supposed to do? Pick one or the other. But what I'm talking about is really the politics of yourselves, of knowing that you have a say-so on how this water policy works. It's obvious by your willingness to come to an evening water seminar on a cold, windy day like today, after we've had a couple of nice days of spring-like weather, that you're involved already. You already know what's going on. So the politics also, I think, is of you educating your neighbors and letting them know that just turning on the tap and then turning it off is not the water policy. It's a lot more complicated than that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Puente. Our final speaker this evening is Laura Marbury. Laura is a senior water analyst with the Environmental Defense Fund in Austin. She works on their land, water, and wildlife program. And in that regard, I understand much of Laura's work has to do with long-term issues of groundwater protection, sustainability, and rural Texas water resources. Also works on outreach and education programs related to both sustainable groundwater management and also conservation. She has a bachelor's degree in geology from the University of Texas and a master's degree in applied geography, I believe, from Southwest Texas State University. And I suspect that Laura's comments this evening may be focused on groundwater. Is that right? Got a good guess. Okay. Ms. Marbury.
Well, thank you, Bill. And I wanted to thank, well, first I wanted to thank the sponsors of this series. I think this is a great, it's just a great idea to actually bring these issues out to everyone out in the Hill Country. I also wanted to thank all of y'all for showing up. It's freezing out there. And it's nice that you came on this day when it was, you know, rainy and cold. Oftentimes I feel like, you know, we're looking for the Holy Grail with water supplies, or the silver bullet that's going to answer all our problems. You know, a number of years ago, and Representative Puente talked about this, there was a restriction put on surface water transfers, interbasin transfers, from one water basin to another. And all of a sudden, everybody started thinking maybe groundwater was going to be what's going to solve our problems. And what we realized, well, and there was, to some degree, there was a lot of speculation. You know, a lot of grand plans were made, and some realistic and some are actually happening, of transferring groundwater from one part of the state to the other. But what we found out is it's not that easy. There's complications. There's people that are using the water now. It's just, it's not going to happen that easily. You know, for a while, brush management was all the rage. The removal of cedar trees in the hill country and the plateau region would free up additional water resources. Don't get me wrong, it does work. You know, it had use under the right circumstances, but it's not necessarily going to free up all the water we need to support this growing population. Desalination, that's also now a very hot topic, both of saltwater, brackish groundwater. I think it's going to serve a role and also, you know, help to supply our water in the future, but it's not going to solve all the problems. The energy costs are high. Especially with brackish groundwater, we're finding out that there's implications. I mean, when you remove that salty water and you free up that space, what does it do to the fresh groundwater? You know, what happens to the neighboring aquifers? So there's complications. There's more to think about. And what do you do with the waste? So nobody ever claimed that water issues were simple and uncomplicated, especially when you get into the realm of policy and planning. So what I wanted to focus on tonight was actually two different issues, you know, in groundwater that are no exception to that. One is a top priority across the state. Groundwater managers and planners are dealing with it right now. The other one isn't so much, but should be. So I want to talk about availability, and I want to talk about interconnectivity. An important part of managing any resource is you have to know how much you have, how much is available. You think that determining groundwater available would be a scientific endeavor. You know, it's as simple as, you know, how deep or how thick is the aquifer, what's the aerial extent, you do some mathematical calculations, and out pops a number. But is that really availability? You know, is the total volume of water in the aquifer really all recoverable? Well, no, that's not realistic, because it's not. I mean, it's some of it's too expensive to pump. Some of it's tied up in the pore spaces. So then is availability of groundwater, the total volume of groundwater that's recoverable? Well, even if it's recoverable, it might actually be in use somehow. You know, in most cases, aquifers are dynamic systems. You have water flowing into the aquifer, but you also have water flowing out of the aquifer. You have outflows as springs. You have outflows as base flows to rivers and creeks. You have water coming from one aquifer, recharging into a neighboring aquifer. So even though it's recoverable, it might be serving another purpose. So perhaps availability, as far as management and planning is concerned, is some volume that's less than what's fully recoverable, but not so great that you impact important or essential uses of aquifer outflows that are happening now and into the future. And that's where it gets sticky. That's where it gets complicated, and that's what makes this an important policy discussion. You know, what are those important and essential uses or outflows? You know, changes in aquifer volume can impact spring flows. It can impact base flows. It can impact shallow wells. If the water table drops, the shallow wells aren't going to be able to, there's going to be no water to pull from. They'll actually have to set the pumps lower. It can affect the health of an aquifer. And by that, I mean during drought conditions, when it rains, you might have an aquifer that's got a good water table, will rebound quickly through that precipitation. If you have one that's actually being depleted, it's going to take longer, so it's going to exacerbate these drought conditions. The state's current method of management, which Representative Puente went into, is the creation of these groundwater conservation districts. You know, they're locally elected boards. They fund themselves through well permit fees. Some of them can tax. Many times they cover just one county. A good example is the Headwaters Groundwater Conservation District, which actually the boundary is Kerr County. Many in the Hill Country are just single county districts. These districts have been given the authority by the state to make policy decisions about availability. They're allowed to regulate and control groundwater use within their boundaries to set that availability and keep the volume of water that they want in the aquifer there. Some of them have, some of them haven't. You know, we have 9 major aquifers in the state, 21 minor aquifers. There's over, I don't know the exact number, but there's over 90 groundwater districts, and not even all the state parts of the state are covered by these districts. But some are actually effectively managing. Again, the Headwaters District, and we actually have Mary Ellen Summerlin is on their board. And oh, and okay, and we have another board member, too, so two, which is great. They're actually a good example of a groundwater district that is trying to get a handle, and somewhat successful, a handle on that availability issue within their district. You know, they don't give out any new well permits, actually, for the Plateau Aquifer, which is where the springs are flowing and the source water for the Guadalupe River. Another good example from the Hill Country is the Cow Creek Groundwater District down in Kendall County. You know, they just put a moratorium on any new well permits so that they can actually have a break and figure out what that availability issue is before they over-permit the resource, and then it's too late. Not all the districts in the state are that advanced. They're underfunded. They're not, you know, for whatever reason. Or say they know that information, they're working it, but they're not telling their neighbor. They're not telling the district next door that's managing the same aquifer. So what we've seen in the policy realm and what Representative Puente discussed was this movement towards more regional focus. You know, we have these single county districts. We have, you know, independent entities that are making these decisions. So there's been this push to say, okay, well, y'all need to start coordinating your efforts. And over the last two sessions, we've seen that movement of actually a mandated effort for this cooperation or greater cooperation. It's the groundwater management area process that he talked about. So the state was split up into 16 different groundwater management areas. They now have to, within each of those areas, the districts have to share management plans. But their big charge, which is causing a lot of excitement, but some friction, some efforts at the local level, is the adoption of these adopted or desired future conditions. What happens is the groundwater management area adopts a desired future condition. This goes to the state. It goes to the Water Development Board. The board actually runs the numbers, does the calculation, and sends back availability number. And that number, the districts actually use that in their management plans, and eventually the regional water planners will use that when they're doing their regional planning. So, in essence, what the state's asking them to do, or what they've asked them to do, is you guys sit down together at the table and figure out what you want your aquifer to look like in the future. The groundwater management area for this area is actually called GMA-9, and that includes most of the Hill Country counties. It's Kerr, Bandera, Blanco, Kendall, Northern Bear, Western Comal, Western Hayes, Southwestern Travis. I think that's all of them. And an example is, for a while they were considering a desired future condition of a 35-foot decline in the Trinity Aquifer. This area is the headwaters for all or part of most of the major rivers of Central Texas. The Trinity Aquifer is also a source for the Edwards Aquifer. It's recharged into that aquifer system. So in deliberating a desired future condition for this area, it's really essential that the districts, both here and everywhere else in the state, understand the balance of current use when they're figuring out this availability. They understand and include important outflows, such as the current uses, such as people that are using shallow wells, or what are the springs flows, what are the base flows, and balance that with meeting future demands. You know, as a landowner or a resident of this area, you have a stake in these decisions. It's important to talk with your groundwater districts, corner them after the talk tonight, and get to know them. They're making these decisions on your behalf, and it's real important that the voice of everyone is heard in this matter. A really interesting, there's actually a GMA 13 that is down southeast of San Antonio. And one thing that they're having problems with is when they're thinking about availability is the aquifer there, the Carrizo Wilcox, is under artesian pressure. So it's actually, which means it's a confined aquifer, and if you drill a well into it or if there's a fracture into it, the internal pressure of the water actually drives it up to the surface or close to it. So what they're trying to debate now is how much of that artesian pressure do we save? Because it's not really like you're drawing down the water table, but you're drawing down the pressure, which would then make it harder to pump, and it might make it so that there's the springs aren't making it to the surface. It's just a very, I mean, that's just another example of a complication that we're finding through this GMA process. And getting back to the interconnectivity issue, you know, a large part of the problem for managing groundwater and planning is that many parts of the state, including this area, we just don't have the science. You know, we don't know how interconnected the aquifer is with the creeks and rivers or how interdependent one aquifer is with another. I know there's been this disconnect. Within this series, y'all talked about or heard about the disconnect between surface water law and groundwater law. And because of this disconnect, I think we're a little bit behind on the science. You know, so as we make these groundwater availability decisions, and if we don't consider the impacts to the surface water, we're cutting off our own feet. You know, it goes the other way too. We can do all the great in planning when it comes to environmental flows, but if we don't take groundwater into consideration, if we don't understand how much water is actually coming out of the system, you know, you can plan all you want, but in the end, you might not have enough water. I mean, we need to understand what that relationship is. So hopefully what I'm seeing as far as where do we go from here or what do we see in the future is there's going to be a greater emphasis on funding, you know, giving developing funds for the groundwater districts so they actually can develop the science at the local level so they can start collecting better data, so they can build a better framework of understanding that intra-aquifer relationship and also the interconnectivity of our water resources. You know, what I hope is happening now and I hope we'll see more of in the future is also the realization among groundwater managers, among the legislatures, and everybody that these outflows, that spring flows, it's not an environmental issue at all. It's a downstream surface water permit holder issue. It's a coastal fishery issue. It's everybody's issue just because they're so interdependent. It's an amazing dynamic relationship, and so we need to plan accordingly. One thing I also wanted to talk about is that we're seeing a really good emphasis now on land stewardship and the important role that good land stewardship practices plays with our water resource management. It's important to maintain healthy landscapes. This helps regulate runoff. It helps increase recharge rates to the underlying aquifers. You know, I think we're going to see more widespread use of comprehensive land watershed models in the Hill Country specifically, just to target areas, you know, where do we get the most bang for our buck as far as brush management? You know, where can we actually focus in on our efforts of land stewardship so that we can enhance the recharge? And we're seeing a greater role, because of this, we're seeing a greater role of the individual landowner. I mean, most of our state is in private hands. So it really is important for the landowner to be involved in those discussions. So the plain truth of the matter is that there's no easy magical answer about water resources. You know, it's something that we're all dependent on, and we're going to have to figure this out. And, you know, one thing that I think that it's just important for y'all to take home with you, which are here tonight, which, you know, is the first step, is that you just need to let your voice be heard. I mean, this is a resource that we all depend on, especially in the Hill Country, where your economy, your livelihood is so dependent on the resource that we need to make sure that value is also part of the equation when we're figuring out what is the value of water. So, thank you.
Thank you, Laura. I'd like to invite the panelists up to the table. It's the opportunity for you in the audience to ask questions. We have a microphone set up in the center aisle. If you'll come forward and ask your questions. You can either direct a question at an individual panelist member, at the panel as a whole, and after the question is answered, we'll be sure to give everybody a chance to make any comments they may have. So someone have a question?
This crazy what-if question. Do you think the day will ever come, given the growing awareness of the importance of water, that the state may regulate underground water as well as surface?
If I could answer that, well, we already do regulate groundwater to some extent with the groundwater districts, but very little. But if you look at the Edwards Aquifer Authority, that's where we truly have done away with the rule of capture. And if you want, in my opinion, want to talk about groundwater policy, you look at the Edwards Aquifer Authority. Everything that can be done is being done right there. As I mentioned, rule of capture is gone. Water markets have been created. There's rules and regulations that protect the rural counties as far as making sure that part of the water stays with the land. You can only transfer 1 acre foot of water from the land. One acre foot has to stay with the land. It protects the farming community. As I mentioned, it's a water market, so we know what water costs within that region. There's bidding going on. There's banking going on. There's leasing. SAWS, for example, leases some farms. They allow the farmer to do dry land farming, but they get credit for the water. The water's not physically transported, but they get credit back in San Antonio in those pumps. So if the state of Texas wants to start really regulating groundwater, I think there's a test already in the Edwards Aquifer.
And just to add a quick comment about a lot of the western states in the western U.S. have moved in that direction of doing sort of a coordinated or unified system of operation, recognizing the points that Laura was making. You know, our assumption on the way we do surface water availability, again, as I mentioned about expecting rainfall to be repeated over the last 50 years to be repeated in the future in the next 50 years. The other thing we're assuming is that the groundwater contribution that we got through springs in the last 50 years is also going to be repeated over the next 50 years. Well, that's not going to happen either. And so the reality that a lot of Western states have faced up to is that you can't really do a good job of regulating either one if you don't regulate them in some sort of conjunctive manner. And I think eventually we will get there through some form or another. And I think the Edwards was an example where it was so stark that it was clear. We just couldn't do it in the way we have done it traditionally. And I think eventually we will get there some mechanism for doing that sort of conjunctive management, even here in Texas. Okay.
Pass it this way. You know, and I think, you know, right now, or with the passage of the bill to initiate this groundwater management area process, I think what the legislature was saying is, okay, you guys, you're single counties, you're not necessarily talking, show us what you can do. You know, we're going to give you till 2011 or 2010, I can't remember what the deadline is, but y'all have got 4 years, you know, everybody sit at the table and start hashing this out, and everybody is watching. I mean, that's the interim committees have it on their agenda. They're talking about how is the GMA process working? How are the districts making their decisions? Is it, you know, is it going along smoothly? Who's submitting them so far? You know, and the rumbling you hear in the background is, you know, now we're doing regional cooperation. I think we're going to see a movement towards more regional control. I don't know what form that's going to take or how soon that's going to happen. But I think that's where we're moving. You know, we talk about the districts being able to modify the rule of capture. There's 20% of the state that's not even within a groundwater district, and it's not areas that don't have water. An example is Val Verde County, which is the Devil's River is out there. There's a large volume of water coming. They don't have a district. I mean, so I think that's one thing we're going to see in maybe the next session or the one off after that is some sort of, you know, either in creating districts for those areas or creating like a comprehensive district that brings in all the white areas. But I think that we're moving towards that. But the districts right now have the opportunity to work together and show the legislature, show the policymakers that they can do it without that hand of Austin, you know, telling them what to do.
This is out of our local area, but the implications at some point are going to be spread everywhere. But I just wonder what your comments are regarding two different things. One, T. Boone Pickens in West Texas, that has got a large acreage position, says he's going to transport groundwater from there back toward Dallas purely for profit. And the other question is regarding the Barnett Shale development, which is up in north central Texas. Each of these wells have got to be fracked with large volumes of water, order of magnitude 25 million gallons of water to frack the well. After the well is produced for a while, and, you know, because the fracture system doesn't go out that far, when it's depleted, they can go back and refract, so they're going to be continually doing this, and a lot of places up there are already beginning to hurt for water. Is anything being done in those two regards?
I guess I can go ahead and... Oh, do you want to speak? Okay. Well, I know, I'll take the Barnett Shale question first, is that, you know, this is something that I might steal your thunder, but the legislature did look at it last year, and they did create groundwater district that incorporates some of it's Parker County and Wise. There's about a 5-district area up there that there was a district that was created so that they could help start trying to manage the aquifer up there where the Barnett Shale recovery processes were going on. I think we're going to hopefully see a strong district up there that can work with the people, the local landowners, and also work with the gas industry to try to figure out how to deal with this issue. As to the T. Boone Pickens, I mean, that's groundwater marketing in Texas, it's alive and well in some parts of the state. And with T. Boone Pickens, it's kind of complicated because what he's doing is taking water from an area that is not necessarily – it's in the Ogallala, but it's not necessarily farmed, or they're not withdrawing water from that area. So I've actually heard it termed as stranded surplus water. So what he's doing is taking this water, marketing it elsewhere, and, you know, it's hard when you have an area that the water is coming to, say Dallas, where they aren't conserving, and how do you deal with that issue of balancing the fact that he wants to sell the water with, well, let me, I'm starting to get, let me.
Let me hand it over.
There are a lot of people that what T. Boone Pickens is doing, a lot of people that feel that it is not a problem. All of the ranchers in North Texas that have signed up leases with him do not think it's a problem at all. They look forward to being able to sell their water. Obviously, T. Boone Pickens himself, seeing water as a commodity, looks to make a huge profit on this. But your question is, are we doing anything to stop it? Well, I think the profit portion of it is stopping Boone because there's no profit yet. In other words, he hasn't found a market that's willing to pay the prices that it'll take for him to withdraw the water and pipe it down to its market. He shopped it to San Antonio, and San Antonio said it was just way too expensive. And luckily, Sawz has a philosophy that they're not going to get into a water project where it creates a win-lose situation. They want a win-win situation. Dallas-Fort Worth, I think, is going to look at existing reservoirs and future reservoirs for their future water supply. So I think Mr. Pickens is still caught in the free enterprise system that he has something, but he has no market for it. So for right now, that's what's stopping him.
Just one quick comment on the Barnett Shale issue. One of the things that sort of highlights is another issue in groundwater management is the issue of exempt wells that complicate how groundwater districts manage water. There are a lot of wells that are exempt from regulation and certain uses that are exempt from regulation from groundwater districts, and particularly in these near suburban areas that Robert was talking about earlier, where you have a lot of people coming in and a lot of individual wells, that can be a huge drain on these aquifers that further complicates the ability of these groundwater districts to really meaningfully manage the aquifer because there are these uses that they can't regulate.
Representative Puente, how important do you think land planning and land use regulation is in the equation of water resource planning? And do you think Texas is ready for more land use planning authority in the rural county, in the unincorporated areas, the counties?
Are you talking about land stewardship or just regular land planning?
More land use regulation.
Okay. It's obviously very important. And the big problem is that the high-growth areas are either right in the fringes of a city and maybe not even in the city's ETJ where the city cannot regulate the development, and they're out in the county, and counties have very little regulatory power. And every session a bill is filed to give counties more regulatory power, and every session it fails. And it usually fails because the residents themselves of the counties want it that way. They don't want regulation. They want to be that's why they live in the county and not the city. And so there's a catch-22 there where the development is occurring. There needs to be regulation. The counties want regulation, but they can't get it because the legislature won't give it to them. And within the counties themselves, we hear mixed signals that they want some regulation but not this type of regulation. So there's that ongoing problem. So it's been done piecemeal. For example, counties have the ability to do septic tank regulation. That at least is part of it. One thing that I have done in my role as a chairman, when bills would come to my committee that dealt with the creation of municipal utility districts, public improvement districts, or these kinds of districts that are created to allow there be a development, is to ask for that, to ask that there be some type of, before they can have the election that creates that district, that there has to be an agreement in place that allows for within the agreement on how they're going to get water, where they're going to get the water, what's going to be done with the wastewater, the size of the lots, all these agreements that either the county or the city can use to control the developer. One example was right down the road here in Burney, if any of you all knew the I think it's Esperanza Development. Part of that that came out of Austin, and the legislation said that there has to be an agreement between the city and the developer on how they're going to develop that subdivision. So then the city had the ability, even though it was outside of their area, to have some control, because obviously they could annex and all those kinds of issues. So it's very important, but unfortunately the state's not giving the counties very much authority on that to do anything about it.
I speak from the standpoint of a member of the Groundwater Conservation District, and there are some things about Chapter 36 that could well be tightened up, like the loopholes for exempt wells, especially related to the oil industry. But more fundamentally, it seems to me, is money. And I wonder if you think there is any consensus building in Austin to do more about funding. The regional planning areas are funded for what they have to come up with. The GMAs are not. Now, Headwaters happens to be in good shape financially, and so we can invest a lot of money in monitor wells and begin to gather that basic data that everybody depends on. But some of the other groundwater conservation districts in our groundwater management area are totally unable to do that kind of investment. It just seems to me like if we want this to work at the state level, we got to put some more money resources into this from Austin. It seems to me the Texas Water Development Board in the GMA process, I've been our representative, and I've been very impressed with what the Texas Water Development Board can do for us. But they're always short-staffed. They need more money, too.
You're absolutely right. We do need more money to get the right kind of science involved. But we as a state, we don't even adequately fund public education. we don't even adequately fund Health and Human Services. And so that's one of the things that you're going to see that it's not going to come from Austin, to be very frank with you, because of the belief that that we shouldn't pay for anything. And you say, you know, money coming from Austin. Well, before it gets to Austin, it comes from you. So you send it to Austin, then we send it back to you. So it's not just free money from Austin. It'll cost somebody something. And the only reason we were able to do that, when you talked about the regional planning groups, and it did cost a lot of money to get this planning off the ground, just as important as the planning that y'all have to do with the desired future conditions portion, is we had I don't remember, you remember the 90s, we had a big budget surplus, big enough to do historic renovation of county courthouses through all the rural counties. A lot of money was available to us, and we set aside a good chunk of money for regional planning. And unfortunately, we probably will have to wait for a drought to coincide with the budget surplus before we can do something meaningful like that.
Make this a general question here, but I've been taking some copious notes here. I found it all very interesting to have such knowledgeable folks here. And, you know, back in my grandfather's time at the turn of the 20th century, he was driving a horse and buggy out in West Texas and had a horse blanket with a Colt 44 under it for varmints. Now, that was two-legged kind, four-legged kind, and whatnot. But back in that era, you know, Texas could afford to have a legislature that only met 2 months every 2 years. And, you know, we've seen the figures here for the population growth in Texas from 1850 to 1950 and today. And I did some calculations. The first 100 years, it went up a factor of almost 35. The next 50 years, it was 3.5, roughly. So what's it going to be? And we have modern technology. We've got rapid communications, rapid information dissemination, a fantastic transportation system and whatnot. Yet the legislature, by the Constitution of Texas, moving and evolving with that Constitution is going at glacial speed, and I think it needs to be a full-time legislature to deal with these kinds of evolving problems that are going almost at the speed of light. This thing is really growing topsy-turvy. And I think 15 years we may see another 10 million people in Texas, and it may be even more than that. Could you comment on that, please?
I thought this was less government country. You know, we have a more conservative state than liberal, and I think we have a state that wants less government. So I think meeting having a full-time legislature, first of all, you'd have to change the Constitution. We would vote on it, and then the general public would vote on it, and I don't think it would happen. Although we do have a state that does demand immediate attention on a lot of these problems. But look at the history of the legislature and of our state. We only do things if we're forced to do them. The state mental health system changed because of a lawsuit, federal judge. Our prison system, federal judge. Our public finance system, state judge. Edwards-Aquifer Authority, federal judge. So the legislature is geared toward not doing anything, to be very frank with you. I'm serious. Our Constitution says that for the first 60 days of the 140 days that we're in session, the first 60 days we are prohibited from passing a bill because we, as a state, want less government. So the first 60 days of the 140, we cannot even pass a bill. So you're left with what happens. And some people like it that way. You know, I liked it that way. The 18 years I was in office, I only had to make that sacrifice every other year of going up to Austin. Got paid $600 a month whether we met in Austin or not. So it would be difficult to change. But I think we should change it, but it would be very difficult.
Okay, we have time for a couple more questions. This gentleman here has been patiently deferring, and
my question has to do with land stewardship, but before I'd like to make a quick promotion for educational purposes. You have a flyer. If you can get one, please get one. This is an educational opportunity for land stewardship. So I have some more if you want one. I'm from Kimball County. We have large ranches there still.
Most of those ranchers are changing their ways. They depend upon, but they still depend on their ag exemptions to be able to afford to ranch.
I'm seeing myself as a new landowner or small landowner coming in, and the tendency is, oh, I don't want to pay taxes on that, on what this land's worth now.
So what's the first answer? Get you some goats and put it on your land and get an ag exemption. Totally contradictory to good stewardship as far as what the results are. And to address that issue of rainwater capture, is there any talk, is there any interest in anywhere about looking at our tax structure and looking at, do we need, I believe we do need an ag exemption for true ag producers, but can we look at something like an exemption that addresses people who are truly trying to do something in the stewardship realm to capture rainwater and to recharge the aquifer?
Well, as you may know, a few years back there was the wildlife exemption. Correct. That was added, which was one move to sort of move in that direction. But I do think that ag exemption has been controversial. Some years, people are saying, well, are we losing income? So I don't know. I mean, the issue of moving it forward, it's the sort of issue that we need to start talking about. What incentives can we provide for people to help with this land stewardship issue? But I think to sell it, what we have to do is be able to make the case that we really are providing benefits to the public. I mean, I think people know that, but in order to have the facts to sell that case, I'm not sure we're there yet to really be able to sell it, because people are going to have to be convinced that there is a true benefit in water supply, water quality, water quantity, enough for the state, to say, well, we may give this, but there may be a loss in some property tax income as a result of that. So I think that's going to be a delicate issue, and I'm not in the legislature. I hang out there some late at night sometimes. But I think that it's an interesting question, and the issue of finding the right incentives for land stewardship, I think, is going to be a promising area to work on in the years ahead, whether that's the first one, the first mechanism that gets approved or not. I don't know. I don't know if Robert wants to comment about any of the controversy with that.
Just that it is controversial. It's the right thing to do, and it's ideas like that that take 2-3 sessions. You have to build on and build on. The wildlife exemption didn't happen just one session. You have to do all the groundwork, all the grassroots. And unfortunately, or fortunately for some people, there's more individuals that think the opposite way than you. They need and want that ag exemption. It's a lot of times the absentee owner. They live in Houston. This is their second home, their retirement area that they're going to come to. They throw those goats on there. And so, yes, a lot of times it's abused. Oftentimes it's not abused. And there's still a big difference of opinion, but I don't think the legislature is ready to do that right now.
Quick comment. And I think, in going off of what Myron said, the ag exemption might not be something that happens so soon, but I think we're going to see, because there is this push on good land stewardship and really understanding how much of a role that plays in our water resources, I think we're going to start seeing more incentives. I think that there's going to be more cooperative efforts with, say, the river authorities or the groundwater districts, where there's some, win-win relationships that are developed with the landowner and that river authority to say if the land is managed a certain way, there'll be some sort of incentive, in the form of financial incentive or something that helps aid that relationship. And I think we're going to see that probably a lot quicker than we're going to see something come out of the legislature.
One of the difficult jobs I have as a moderator is cutting off these great discussions that we have going here as part of our formal session. We have one more. I think you were up as right, am I right? And then we have some refreshments and perhaps can continue the discussion informally, but as far as the formal session, this will have to be our last question.
Well, this might be as much of a statement as it is a question. There are so many issues in our state that require a pretty technical knowledge of what is going on. And it seems as though it's very difficult for the average citizens to have all the information. Personal property rights are very important, especially here in the Hill Country. And yet, if we don't educate people that they will lose all their personal property rights without having some assistance in managing the growth, that it's a loss for all of us, that we have education, that we have mandates from the state that aren't being funded. And it would seem to me that those of you, especially in the legislature, who become more involved in all the issues and see the greater picture, would somehow try to work or plan or allot some funds for better educating the public so we could get to a point where we can really do what's best for our state.
Thank you. I want to thank the panelists for giving of their time. For giving of their time to come with us this evening, but in particular their expertise and their perspectives. And I certainly want to thank Representative Puente for his candor this evening. I think he has been somewhat impolitic with his candor, but we appreciate it. Thank you. And I want to thank the sponsors again, but most of all, I want to thank you people. Many of you have been here for more than one event. The sponsors seem to have an ability to pick particular inclement weather for these activities, especially recently. So thank you very much. I personally think that the solution to these problems, frankly, is not going to come from the panelists, as esteemed as they are, but they're going to come from you, people who are willing to get involved in creating the solutions to these problems. I encourage you to stay in contact with the sponsors of the event. I know they're actively planning next year, and they're discussing how to make next year particularly meaningful in the context of the issues that have been discussed generally over this year. So seek out either the Texas Tech or the Shriner representatives. Thank you.